ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You ever watch the news and think, whoa, this seems...
unprecedented?
Unprecedented.
It's unprecedented.
This has never happened before. This is unprecedented.
I'm Matt Bevan, and my show, if you're listening, is about finding times that what's happening now has happened before and figuring out what we can learn from it. Learning from history. I mean, who could imagine? New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has held a productive and warm phone call with US President Donald Trump. The 40-minute phone call marks the first talks between the two leaders since March, with AUKUS, a few personal issues, and the recent 12.5% US tariff canvassed. Meanwhile, Foreign Minister Penny Wong is set to deliver a speech warning that the melancholic fantasy of monoculturalism is a threat to national security. And in the UK, all eyes are on the Clacton by-election, which has seen far-right reform leader Nigel Farage face off against a bin. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvalis.
And I'm Claire Armstrong.
Claire, we'll come to the Clacton by-election later because I know you have big thoughts on big bins, Nigel Farage versus bin face, although I've got to say it's looking like Farage has beaten the rubbish can.
What a claim to fame.
Now, we're going to start at home, though, because there's been some significant political developments. The biggest one, I think, fair to say, is that the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has held a 40-minute phone call with the US President, Donald Trump, overnight. He labelled the phone call productive, constructive, lengthy and substantial. Claire, you rugged up and you headed to the Prime Ministerial Courtyard in Parliament early this morning. What did he say about this phone call and how significant is it?
There's nothing I love more than at the end of a sitting week nipping into Parliament at like 7 o'clock in the morning to stand outside for half an hour. Not quite as long as the phone call with President Trump, which went for a quite, you know, I think lengthy and substantial is fair to describe a 40-minute phone conversation. They discussed a lot of things. There was no major kind of outcome out of any of those discussions. Obviously, the Prime Minister raised the tariffs that the US have imposed on Australia, and in particular that extra up to the 12.5% tariff that's been levied on us under the guise or claim of there are issues with modern slavery in our supply chains, which Australia obviously rejects. The Prime Minister asking for obviously Australia to have no tariffs, but in the very least to go back to the 10% that we were on. And he essentially described Trump's response as being taken under advisement and that he might consider that request. But he did note that Trump and has a very different view of what the purpose and value of tariffs are to America. So I'm not sure we'll get movement out of that, but significant that they seem to have quite a lengthy conversation on it all the same. Range of other issues, as you'd expect, conflict in the Middle East, some of the development around Pacific AUKUS, critical minerals, increasingly conversations around what's known as Pillar 2 of AUKUS, which is essentially not the submarines. Things like AI, we know that Australia really wants access to, for example, Anthropic's Mythos model, which is that really high-tech, really good at hacking and therefore finding ways to defend against cyber hacking that we were pursuing for our critical infrastructure to be able to essentially apply that to that. But no firm sort of outcomes on any of the broader issues. I think it's just interesting in a way that they've had this conversation. It was born out of an agreement the last time they spoke to basically keep speaking regularly and, you know, box ticked in that regard.
Box ticked, yeah. Of course, they had to have another meeting. Big ally, AUKUS. Just yesterday, Elbridge Colby, who's the undersecretary, essentially responsible for a lot of this defence space, gave a briefing about AUKUS, I think broadly, if you read the words, it was an optimistic kind of take on AUKUS, talked about the obligations that Australia had to, you know, embark on and their own challenges. But I think it was, I think the timing, you know, as the US kind of solidifies its belief that this thing can happen, is key here too. It's interesting though, the tariff issue. Of course he raised it. He has to raise it. He has to be seen and to do and push for a better deal on tariffs. He has to. But I feel like that kind of pressure point of getting a deal on tariffs has absolutely politically evaporated. And that helps the Prime Minister, I think, enormously. So it is a bit tick the box in so much as you make the request, you try, you know, you do everything you possibly can, but in full knowledge that you're probably not going to walk out with anything and that that's not going to be diabolical for your leadership. You know what I mean? Like it's, don't you reckon?
Well, we were talking about this a few episodes ago, I think when we were at Labor conference, that weirdly, what has happened even with these tariffs is in a lot of sectors, Australia's trade to America, like exports to America, have gone up. The demand for our products, things like beef, hasn't actually been impacted by the tariffs. Or in the very least, we've benefited from still being at the lower end of tariffs and some of our international competitors who have had higher rates applied. Because of that, we still look like an attractive option. So I think a not insignificant part of the reason that that pressure isn't there at the moment is because a year and a half on since Liberation Day, when this all kicked off, we're not seeing the economic impact in a negative way that was feared. And that's not to say that the government's got off lucky. That is obviously as a direct result of the work that's been done and the constant engagement, like the mentioning at every opportunity, to just make sure that we say as far as possibly on the kind of right side of this as we can, that we don't end up having extra tariffs imposed on us on other areas. So I completely agree that the political pressure just isn't there domestically at the moment.
Yeah, which is helpful because he'd be doing all of what he's doing, trying to get a deal, all of that, not being necessarily able to get it, and then face the backlash. So that's the bit that is actually working for him on that one right now, that, you know, the dance would be the same either way. It's just that the pressure of not being able to get it would be worse in the alternative universe. Now, the Prime Minister has spoken not once but twice this morning. He's had a busy Friday, so that's why we're giving you extra pod time too, because the man has had a lot to say. So, yes, there was the Trump call and now he's spoken again. And he hasn't been able to, you know, avoid some questions around, I can't stand that we're calling it Melongate.
I'm not calling it Melongate. Oh, good. I'm calling it the Melon Saga. Is that
okay.
Better?
I prefer that. Okay. So I like to be really transparent with our listeners. I'm mad for fruit. I love fruit. I once went to the doctor and was advised that I need to eat less fruit, that it's causing me digestive issues. Like, I love fruit that much. So I have a soft spot for all things melon. And so it upsets me enormously that melons have become the sad saga they have. Now, I know people have heard a lot about this. And I know lots of people think, what is this circus? Why are you even talking about this? But it has got a life of its own now. And now there's another element, which I'm going to throw to you in a second, Claire, because I just...
Gee, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I invite co-hosts. The Bush Deep host, Nikki Osborne, joined Mark Burris. He is a podcaster on a podcast called Straight Talk. She said that the shag, marry, kill question was a standard part of the podcast. She's right. It is. But then she said something else. What did she say?
She said that, yes, this is a part of the podcast and that regularly the three female options given to guests to designate whether they would shag, marry or date them is Pauline Hanson. And she talked on this podcast that's just come out about how it was discussed that they should remove Pauline Hanson because they didn't want it to be controversial to have her in the lineup. I think Rhonda Birchmore might have been the unlucky soul that was subbed in instead. And that has now been put to the Prime Minister in his second press conference of the day. Was the they that this discussion about, you know, taking Hanson out of the question, the they being his office, which he has denied, could have been Nikki's own production team. Nikki goes on a bit further and she says, the Prime Minister, quote, he's watched the show, he knows my podcast, so he knew what he was coming into. And this is where I think it gets interesting for me, and I understand that people think it is ridiculous that we are still talking about this podcast. I mean, the PM chief among them thinks that it's ridiculous we're still talking about this podcast and that we should be talking about other things. I think we have capacity to talk about many things.
We do.
Judgment is an important character of a leader, and making a judgment about when you speak, how you speak, who you engage with, why you do it, all of that is important to examine. And I don't think that the Prime Minister, if he had his time again, would say yes to that podcast. And that's a reflection, that's a learning moment for him on the judgment of doing it. Interestingly, Nikki also says in her interview today that Pauline Hanson was due to come on as a guest, and actually subsequent to the furore around the Prime Minister has politely declined. So when people are questioning why this has trailed on, I think it's trailed on for a couple of reasons. The Prime Minister's never really confronted the judgment question. He got pretty close today when he was asked about would you reconsider or what do you think about going on that podcast. But I think it would have been refreshing to hear him say, you know, even the most progressive, you know, allies of women, men, whatever it is, sometimes they need to check themselves and need to go, this was a moment for me to reflect and go, I might have behaved differently, or I should have behaved differently. He obviously thinks that in terms of having given the apology about the comments about Kylie Minogue. And to go back to the actual Mellon part of this, when the Prime Minister's defence has largely been that Japan, a generally culturally conservative country, wasn't offended and doesn't want to make a big deal out of that, I'm not sure that that's the bar that Australians maybe hold their leader to. Because if this had been Italy, if this had been Meloni, and, you know, she's quite fiery, I'm sure she would have seen something like that, clapped back in the first press conference she was asked about it and moved on. She wasn't, I'm not suggesting this would ever have been a diplomatic incident or anything like that. But it would have been different. And the Prime Minister probably would have had to say, well, I shouldn't have gone there, particularly because the original question was, what is an example of a, quote, crap gift that you have received from a world leader? And that was how we even got into this discussion.
Okay, I'm so glad you mentioned this, because there's the sexist angle, which is, you know, reasonable to discuss, I think. And clearly women across the board have made comments about that. Even if he says he didn't mean it that way, for a lot of people it looked that way. I accept that he tells us he didn't mean it that way. I accept that, because I can't.
Me
what
too.
Else could I do? I can't not accept it.
I don't
it.
Know
like,
his mind. I have to take
correct.
His word.
Correct, exactly. I'm so glad you, yeah, right? But I know when I look at the gesture, I'm like, oh, what's going on with the gesture, right? So, okay, different view about the same gesture. I get it. People keep saying, you talk with your hands. Right now you look at me in the camera like, Claire, we're looking at each other. Like, yeah,
I'm doing it.
Yeah, like all the time. I don't know what I'm doing with my hands, right? So I get all of that. But the your point about the gift, he's trying to be funny and relatable and talking about the funny things. Because, yes, leader to leader, you got to bring a gift, and the gifts you bring, it's like, you know, they get poured over diplomatically by, you know, the countries, as if the Prime Minister or the Japanese Prime Minister are thinking about, you know, they're not going to the local shops to get a gift like I do when I'm visiting a friend and I've forgotten a gift, right? Like they are, it's all organised. But these are very important gifts. This is culturally important to Japan. And that is also not to be made light of. That's the other angle here that a few people have said, why is everyone missing that? It was kind of rude to make a joke while he's in office. I don't know if you've left office years later, but while he's in office, that's a point too, isn't it?
Yes. And I think, you know, there's a bit of crosstalk in the podcast, and there's someone like yourself who watches the Prime Minister quite a lot and understands that he sometimes has a bit of a run up and a wind up before he makes his point. when you take how he starts the conversation, he sort of says, well, I'll tell you about something weird that ended up quite good. So he's obviously thought to himself, I'm not going to respond with an example of a crap gift. But he never quite like rejects the premise of the question. He just launches into the example. So that's where I think it gets a bit prickly. I mean, the other thing that I don't know how widely this is known, like it's no state secret. Do you know what we gave back?
What?
Grapes.
What?
We gave grapes, like the fruit. I don't know if they were special grapes. But
they must have been.
Yeah.
Either way, we are now on Friday that we're recording this. Obviously, the podcast was last month. It has dominated the whole week of politics.
I think it's done now. And this is the thing.
Are you like, really calling it?
I'm calling it because...
Good luck to you calling it.
Okay.
It's going to have new life next
week
somehow.
It will have... Look, here are the two lasting things I think actually come out of all of this saga. It's a reminder to the Prime Minister and the people around him that he ultimately has control over this kind of discourse, because the press conference he had this morning in the PM's courtyard, where he elaborated on his thinking and his view and the relationship, is a press conference he could have had on Monday. It was always going to go until he basically subjected himself to direct questioning from the media. The second lasting impact of it is I think that the Prime Minister will have to be particularly careful going forward, as he should be anyway, but he now essentially, there's bad faith in between, I think, the public and the Prime Minister, that if another gaffe, another thing happens, there will be far less leniency. Mm. The lasting impact of this is a wariness, perhaps, about the Prime Minister's judgment when it comes to these things, which maybe is taking it all too seriously. He would certainly argue that. I know he's well and truly fed up of this whole conversation and just thinks that he's a hand talker and we should all move on. But I do think that that's probably where the electorate will end up going, is it'll not be this, it'll be the next thing, which, you know, pollies make gaffes, there will be a next thing.
Okay, I want to talk about Penny Wong, because she's giving a pretty significant speech warning that populism threatens national security. Penny Wong's going to deliver this speech at the Lowy Institute today. It's basically, I reckon it's about One Nation, isn't it?
It's a speech about One Nation without mentioning the words One Nation next to each other. Quite clever, really.
Yeah.
We'd expect no less from Penny Wong.
And it comes after Chris Kenny at Sky is working on this documentary at the moment, which is sort of looking at right-wing politics. And he asked questions of Pauline Hanson about, you know, whether she knew, you got to watch it to understand, I'm not giving the perfect description of it, but, you know, about would she go to Indonesia, like our region, and she didn't know the Indonesian presidents, who it was, she didn't know the Japanese president, and few people have commented that it's kind of like her please explain moment.
You know that she had another go. She Tell went me. On Kenny again and got the Japanese prime minister right, still didn't know Prabowo of Indonesia,
okay.
And then pivoted to you've gone at me for gotcha questions, which is a, you know, an age-old defence.
Yeah, the old gotcha questions. Look, you know, and they are like, okay, as in, but I think there's a reason for those questions too, by the way. Like they're often mocked, but they do tell a story. If you want to be a prime minister of a country, I don't think it is. I think some things can be snobby, but I don't know if that's snobby. You're in public life for 30 years. You want to be the prime minister. That's what you're telling us. You kind of do have to know who the regional leaders are. Yeah? Look,
I don't think
that's unreasonable.
And it's an interesting inversion. Normally politicians are already assumed to be snobby and the thing they're asked is like the price of milk. But this has gone the other way.
Oh, that's such a good point. Yeah.
This has gone the other way.
Might be worth asking her the price of milk as well. Like, you know, just because Pauline Hanson is seen as salt of the earth, she'll tell you that, you know, it doesn't mean necessarily, like, I don't know. I've never asked her that question. I don't know. But what I do know is that this speech that Penny Wong's giving is really to go to the impact of monoculturalism, I suppose, in the geopolitical space, the impact of us going inward rather than outward as a country. It's a bigger speech around those themes. And it comes as the Lowy Institute's recent poll, 55% think the number of migrants coming to Australia is too high. So that is all the underbelly here as we talk about culture, right?
It is, and this is a bit of a precursor, I think, to the government is inching closer to nailing down some of the finer details of what we, maybe it's a bit too far, but a bit of a migration crackdown, essentially, that it's due to go through Cabinet for another round of refining next week, might end up being announced by the week as end as well. So as much as Penny Wong doing this speech is very clearly trying to call out that language that motivates a lot of what Pauline Hanson is saying around division, there's a kind of acknowledgement coming from now even Labor, it's long been mentioned by the coalition, that there is something that's going to have to happen with migration to even just take the temperature out of what is happening with the debate.
It has to be clearly neutralised. Like, it has to be, you can't just pretend it's not happening. it's very much, it's not the first and most important issue to people, but it's a real factor for people as their view of the country. And so how to do that in a way that, as the Prime Minister was asked questions about, because they're looking at all these policies at the moment, will you deport people? They're looking at those sorts of things. He's saying he won't do things in a divisive way, rejects the ICE model, so he wants to land at a kind of Labor version of a hardline policy. That's tricky though, right? If you want to hold the line on the broader multicultural question.
Yes, I think looking around, if it's in America or even elsewhere at the moment, Labor would be thinking, well, there's some lessons out there on what not to do, but there's not really a good test case for where the good middle ground is that sort of gets that balance right. Maybe they'll be the first to find it, but I don't know. This has been the perennial kind of debate of Australian politics for since Federation.
Mm. Now, there's some breaking news as we record the podcast. Ex-Victorian Premier Jacinda Allen has officially quit politics. This was inevitable, Claire. I mean, she's been in Parliament for so long in Victoria. This is kind of, she was not going to recontest this seat of Bendigo East. But her electorate is massively under pressure from One Nation now. And, whatever people think of Jacinda Allen at a kind of Victoria-wide level and maybe even nationally, she held that seat for a really long time. And, it's significant, I think. It's going to be very hard for Labor to hold it. That's what I'm saying.
I agree. Bendigo East, a regional sort of Vic centre, Bendigo in general in that area has been the focus of not just One Nation, but even the Nats always wanting to have a crack in that area. There's always a view that Labor's hold on it isn't as strong as it once was, as much as the people that do hold that area have held on. And losing a well-known local candidate, I'm not saying it's exactly the same, but it could go the way of Susan Lee's seat of Farah, where once this sort of prominent local person had stepped down, the protest vote really swung in favour of One Nation.
Yeah, so that's, significant. Does it give Ben Carroll clear air is the other question. I don't think so. I think she was always going to leave at the next election, and that's only a few months away. The sort of stain of the more negative parts of the Andrews Allen legacy will still, dog him, and he's been trying to reset, but we'll see how that continues.
At least he doesn't have to have a by-election, unlike what we're about to talk about.
Mm.
That was a bad segue.
It was perfect. Claire, the only reason we're doing the podcast, we just invented an extra podcast for the week just so we could talk about what is D-Day really for Count Binface versus Nigel Farage. The world is watching for the UK Clacton by-election. The results are pouring in. It looks already like, I think, hasn't Nigel Farage already claimed victory? I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
He was always really going to win. It was a very remote chance that the bin was going to beat him. But still, the bin's never been given such a platform. I've never seen a bin talk so much.
It really is, by UK standards, a by-election of history making. I'll set the scene for you. A metre long ballot paper, longest there's ever been in the UK, 34 candidates, most there's ever been, no Labour, no Conservatives, no Liberal Democrats, and no Restore UK, which is the party that says sort of emerged to the right of reform, Nigel Farage's party. The most number of independents, I think it's about 20, ever on a UK ballot paper. And Farage, who comfortably won the seat in 2024, on track to win again. The votes are being counted. He's already made comments to the effect that he's quite fairly convincingly won. But this is my favourite line. He says, "I have managed to beat the establishment candidate." Candidate singular. The only other candidate that he could possibly be talking about is a comedian who wears a trash can on his head and claims to be from outer space. And if that is what establishment looks like in UK politics, I'm really not sure what the world has come to. But this is the great thing, right? It's been said by a few people. Farage, who quit and sparked this by-election himself, ostensibly to kind of create the idea that he was clearing his name over a probe into a £5 million gift that he got from a crypto investor, saying that the people were going to vindicate him by returning him to Parliament and voting against the establishment. Well, the establishment didn't come out to play. A man with a bin on his face did. And at best, Farage will be able to claim by the time we go to bed that he beat a bin. That's what he's done.
Yeah. Let's not forget what Farage's original and I think enduring kind of ambition was, which is to become the Prime Minister and defeat sort of the Labour government. Now, of course, they have in Andy Burnham a new Prime Minister. But look, at the end of the day, beating a bin, it's something, Claire. I mean, it's not quite the whole goal.
I mean, in defence of that bin, he's potentially going to get some of the later polls were up to 20% of the vote. I mean, the coalition here on the last news poll, I think we're on about 18 nationally. That's not a bad showing. I don't think he's had like scores of volunteers out door knocking and collecting.
No, it's actually, when you put it that way, it's an incredible result, yeah, for a literal comedian bin. Like it's insane. And, you know, Fran has been on the record in the podcast with her concerns about this silly business of, you know, sort of parody, satirical candidates rather than the real business of comedy, a real business, sorry, of politics.
Is politics not comedy?
Yeah, it totally is. And Count Binface like tells the story of our times, doesn't it? Like we are in a particularly weird part of history, it feels.
Absolutely. It's a joke until it isn't, right? And it's the protest vote within the protest vote. Farage's rise as an alternate to the major parties. And here he is being sort of undermined, at least in terms of public commentary and attention. Obviously, Clacton is very strongly a reform seat. There was almost no chance he wasn't going to win it. But such is the discontent with the state of a lot of politics in the Western world that there is usurpers coming for the usurpers. And that's, on a more serious note, exactly what Restore is in the UK. It'd be the equivalent here of if Pauline Hanson does find, you know, comparative electoral success in 2028, that all of a sudden a party in Australia emerged to the right of One Nation because all of a sudden it's viewed that One Nation are not as the place to park your protest vote or going far enough in the direction that some voters want. So it's silly, but it's emblematic of what's going on everywhere.
I agree. A good day to be a citizen of the world, bin or not. That's it for Politics Now today. Claire, thank you for helping me deal with some really weird content today.
Today has been so full, and we didn't even mention, although I'm sure you will next week, that a big old report into the GST carve-out is coming later this afternoon. So there'll be war in the Federation, I think, coming soon from Western Australia and others. So there's plenty more to discuss out of today.
Look, the GST wars are both my favourite and least favourite thing to talk about. We'll be back on Monday for a special Monday edition of the show. If you've got questions for us, send it to theparty room at abc.net.au. Fran and I will answer it. See you, Claire.
See you, PK.